Good morning and welcome to the public meeting, the very first one, on the feasibility study of the shore-based ballast water reception and treatment facilities in California. This is the first of the three workshops that will happen over the span of this project. And I want to now ask our lead scientist, Cliff Daum, to introduce the panel.
So welcome on behalf of the Delta Science Program and the Delta Stewardship Council. I wanted to just say a few introductory remarks. First of all, the Delta Science Program is very pleased to be coordinating and facilitating the first public meeting for the feasibility study for shore-based ballast water reception and treatment facilities in California. We're also very happy to facilitate this review on behalf of the State Lands Commission to help them in their efforts regarding California's interim performance standards for the discharge of ballast water. This feasibility study will contribute to the development of a potentially broader and more effective range of treatment options. And when completed, the study will suggest actions that could be taken to further improve the prevention of non-native species introductions via shipping vessels. This review also fits the mission and vision of the Delta Science Program. Our vision is that all Bay Delta water and environmental policy is founded on the highest caliber science. And secondly, our mission is to provide the best possible unbiased scientific information for water and environmental decision-making in the Bay Delta system. So the Delta Plan from the Delta Stewardship Council addresses non-native species as a major obstacle to successful restoration of the Delta ecosystem, because these species affect survival, the health, and the distribution of native Delta species and animals. Animals and plants both. And on behalf of the Delta Science Program, we'd like to thank the dedicated members of the planning committee, planning team who worked alongside our staff, and they played critical roles in coordinating this review panel. And then last but certainly not least, this review would not be possible without our nationally and internationally recognized independent science review panel. We thank them for their service, and at this point in time, I'm going to ask each of the panel members to briefly introduce themselves, state their affiliation, and give us a little background on their areas of expertise. We'll go ahead and just start here.
Good morning. Good morning. My name is Rick Harkins. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. I'm a marine engineer. I'm retired, have been a marine engineer for about 45 years. Mostly on Great Lakes systems. Had some experience with ballast water, installing some of the first ozone hydrocyclone filter systems on a ship on the Great Lakes back in 1997.
The Environmental Protection Agency in Washington and in the Office of Research and Development. And I've also had a fairly long career in academia doing water-related research. And so I'm pretty pleased to be here and I've worked a little bit on ballast water systems from a research perspective. So I'm pretty excited to learn about how this proceeds.
Good morning. I'm Bill Cooper. I'm a marine chemist, a marine atmospheric chemist in disguise. I actually was the director of a drinking water research center at Florida International University for about 15 or 16 years and then moved to the University of North Carolina, Wilmington as the department chair of chemistry and then stepped down from that after 3 years and become a professor of chemistry and marine science. I then came out to the University of California, Irvine, where I'm still a professor, and I directed for 7 years the Urban Water Research Center. And presently, I'm on loan from UC Irvine to the National Science Foundation, where I run the Environmental Engineering Program. My research has included analytical methods for the determination of disinfectants, primarily chlorine, but also ozone. I've done a lot of work in advanced oxidation processes. Water reuse. I ran the Army's water reuse program in the 70s for several years. And most recently, or more recently, I've actually done some work on two 850-foot tankers where we were using inline continuous ozonation for ballast water control. So with that, I will hand you over to Christine.
Good morning. I'm Christine Moffitt. I'm a native of California. But I'm currently in Idaho, where I'm a professor at the University of Idaho and part of the USGS Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit. I am very engaged in aquatic biology studies and including a lot of studies on invasive species, control methods, chemical applications, and some work on ballast system disinfection systems. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Steve Hackett. I am professor and chair in the Department of Economics at Humboldt State University. I'm also a member of the graduate faculty in the Energy Technology and Policy program there. I'm a faculty associate at the Schatz Energy Research Center. I do a lot of research on fisheries economics. I also have done work on marine energy applications. I'm currently leading a project looking at socioeconomic baseline and change associated with California's North Coast marine protected areas, and I'm delighted to be here today.
Okay, thank you for the introductions, and I'm going to now turn the microphone over to Reiner Haneke, who's going to give us a little bit of background on today's activities.
Thank you, Cliff. Good morning, everyone. I just want to mention a couple of logistics issues, just in case you knew our principal investigator team from Glaston and Associates. Thank you very much for making the trip down here from Seattle, and you'll have an opportunity to introduce yourselves in a little bit. Just some context that might be helpful for the panel. Ever since the development of the interim ballast water treatment standards that were approved by the state legislature back in, I think, 2007, I believe, 2006, somewhere around there. This topic of ballast water treatment has been fairly controversial in California because the California standards are so strict that so far it's been hard to show that the existing shipboard treatment approaches can actually meet the standards. And therefore, we were asked by the State Lands Commission to lend credibility, relevance, and legitimacy to the fact-finding process of determining if shore-based treatment is feasible given the different and unique types of port and marine facilities that we have here and also freshwater ports that we have in California. So with that, the Delta Science Program was approached by the State Lands Commission and said, can you provide an independent, you know, can you be the independent entity that can manage this project and make sure that it gets the best treatment that it can get? So with that, I just wanted to find out, George, if you have any other things you wanted to mention. So thank you all for being here.
Thanks, Reiner. I just want to quickly go over the format. Pardon?
Closer.
Good now? I quickly want to go over today's format for the meeting. We have two presentations, one in the morning and one in the afternoon. After the presentation from Glaston Associates, we'll have the panel with some clarifications and questions and some comments. And following that, we would have a public comment period. Those of you who are interested in coming up and with your comment, please fill in the blue cards that's at the back at the entrance, and we will call you in order. There's also a sign-up sheet up there. Please remember to sign your name up there. There is a Wi-Fi that's open. I think it's under auditorium. The last thing is, please turn off your cell phones. And Reiner already mentioned the restrooms. Public meeting portions of this review include today's presentations to the panel and the dialogue between the presenter and the panel. And as stated in the meeting notice, order of the agenda items are subject to change. And presentations from this review will be posted on our website in a day or two after the meeting. So at this point, I want to invite the team from Glaston to come up and introduce your team. And
buttons on. Hello? That's better. Okay. Well, thank you very much for the introductions. To the members of the panel and to George and Reiner and the others at the Delta Stewardship Council, I'd like to say good morning. And I want to express our great appreciation for the presence of this expert panel to review and provide feedback on our draft literature review. I would now like to introduce our core team for this feasibility study. From Glosson, I'm Peter Soles. I'm the project manager. We also have Mr. Rusty Roberts and Mr. Kevin Reynolds at the end of the table, who's the principal in charge for this project. Glosson is a Seattle-based naval architecture, marine engineering, and ocean engineering firm of more than 90 associates. Our primary area of expertise is vessel design, but we also have considerable in-house experience on the topic of ballast water treatment technologies and regulation. Representing KPFF is Mr. Todd Graham, next to Kevin. KPFF is an engineering firm of over 900 employees operating out of 20 offices across the country with a focus on transportation and infrastructure projects. They have extensive expertise on port and waterfront development projects, including a number of recent large-scale projects in California ports. From Kennedy Jenks, we have Ross Dunning, who's not here yet, and Mr. Jean Dubrow next to Todd. Kennedy Jenks offers specialized services on stormwater and wastewater treatment and regulatory compliance, as well as environmental planning and engineering. They have also performed numerous projects in the state, including the Delta area specifically. Kennedy Jenks operates 28 offices across California and 13 other states. So each of these three groups have already and will continue to call on their many internal resources as we forge ahead with this study. So this is our core team, and our belief is that our combined experience will contribute to an objective, thorough, and well-informed report to the council. In support of our core team, we have some additional help from Dennis King and Associates. Dennis King of King and Associates, who's an expert on marine economics and who has studied the economics of shore-based ballast water treatment on past projects. ODIC Environmental, who will assist with environmental permitting and regulatory requirements. And Nicholas Welshmeyer of Moss Landing Marine Laboratories, who will assist with marine ecology, especially as related to Sacramento and San Joaquin Delta and the potential impacts of treated ballast water discharges. On behalf of our team, we're very proud to be leading this important study for the Council and the State of California, and we're happy to be here today to present to you our draft literature review on the subject of shore-based ballast water reception and treatment. There you go. So I'm going to be literature, meaning non-peer-reviewed work, promotional papers, corporate brochures, and the like. To capture the most current body of knowledge, we targeted papers authored within the last 10 years. Once we felt we had a comprehensive list of sources, we reached out to key personnel at EPA, California State Lands, and IMO, who are knowledgeable on the topic, to vet the list and to suggest any additional sources that we may have overlooked. Ultimately, we ended up with a list of over 30 documents that included discussion on shore-based treatment. Of those, 6 studies focused specifically on the topic and offered original and substantial insight. As a result, our literature review is focused on summarizing and critiquing those 6 reports. In reading through these documents, in developing the literature review, particular attention was paid to the various combinations of vessel type, the method of water conveyance, and treatment type evaluated in each study. Also, the applicability to the state of California, and the 3 themes that the council identified as relevant to the project, which are vessel modifications, port logistics, and shore-based treatment approaches. So before I hand it over to Rusty, I want to take a minute to define a few key terms and acronyms. Firstly, we're interpreting shore-based treatment to include all forms of treatment not wholly supported by the marine vessel itself. This includes mobile treatment approaches like trucks and barges, as well as any new or existing treatment facilities. Also important here is the distinction that we make between what is treatment technology and what is a treatment approach. We feel that these terms are readily confused. We use treatment technology to mean a specific technique for removal or inactivation of organisms in ballast water. So this would be, for example, filtration, ozonation, UV. We use treatment approach to mean a general method for implementing ballast water management, irrespective of the treatment technology itself. I also want to take a minute to draw attention to the California Interim Ballast Water Treatment Performance Standard, which, of course, is one of the primary reasons for taking a hard look at shore-based treatment, as Reiner was saying. Currently, ballast water treatment systems have been evaluated to an international standard as part of the 2004 IMO Convention on Ballast Water Management and are now being evaluated, however, are not yet approved to the U.S. Coast Guard final rule on ballast water treatment. There is currently a gap in the tools and analysis for evaluating these treatment systems to the California standard, which on a numerical basis is 1,000 times more stringent in the 10 to 50 micron size class and quite... Okay, lastly, these are the relevant project themes as identified by the Delta Stewardship Council: vessel modifications, port logistics, and treatment approaches. Breaking it down into the simplest terms, vessel modifications is... what do we have to do to the vessel to get it ready for shore-based reception and treatment? Port logistics is, what are the changes to routine port operations that would be necessary for adoption of a shore-based treatment approach? And treatment approaches is, what do we do with the water once it comes ashore? How do we handle it? How do we move it? How do we store it? How do we treat it? How do we discharge it? At this point, I'm going to pass the podium over to Rusty, who will introduce the six studies that we examined in the review. Rusty.
Great. Thanks very much, Peter. Again, my name is Rusty Roberts. I'll be talking about the six studies that we looked at in detail in our literature review. So these six studies cover a wide range of implementation options, types of treatment approaches, and geographic regions of interest. Brown and Caldwell looks at the Port of Milwaukee and looks at using a barge-based treatment approach using development of concept designs and cost estimates to determine feasibility. Hilliard looks at a large-scale shipping region, the Caspian shipping region, and examines specific vessel practices to determine how shore-based treatment might be implemented in that region. Pereira looks at two large iron ore ports in Brazil and uses a discrete event simulation model to determine the minimum treatment rate and storage capacity necessary to treat all ships with a shore-based treatment approach. Cowie takes a case study-based approach, looking at two and other ports in Denmark, and performs cost estimates for these case studies. King looks at the possibility of performing contingency treatment for ships entering the Port of Baltimore. So assuming a shore-based regime, it looks at treating any ships that, for one reason or another, cannot treat their own ballast water and need some shore-based support. And finally, the ballast water treatment boat, or BWT boat concept, looks at two large-scale shipping regions, the Asia-Oceania shipping region and a European shipping region, and looks to examine if all vessels operating within those regions can be treated with a relatively small number of ballast water treatment boats. Brown of Caldwell, again, looks at the Port of Milwaukee and begins by, in their first phase of the study, developing alternatives to shipboard treatment. So they look at each step in the treatment process, from getting the ballast water off of the vessel to transporting the ballast water to some type of storage or treatment facility and discharging the ballast water. And they determine what they think is the most feasible option. And in phase two, they decide to move forward with a barge-based treatment approach, and they develop concept designs and cost estimates for this approach. The Port of Milwaukee receives about 85 vessel calls annually during its 8-month. The relevant findings from this report were really the cost estimates developed for both modifying vessels to use this barge-based treatment facility and for the necessary cost estimates for developing the barge treatment facility itself. For vessel modifications, they found a range of $60,000 to upwards of $200,000 for the smaller and larger ship, respectively. one of the main conclusions on port logistics was that the existing port infrastructure at the Port of Milwaukee was really important in determining what the best transport method would be. So while the port as a whole had some rail car infrastructure and some pipelines to transport water, they found that these were not heavily supported at the grain terminal, which is the terminal of interest, and so they used a barge-based approach so that transport wouldn't be necessary. And again, they found the barge-based approach can simplify operations by combining these treatment, transport, and storage options. And here's a quick summary of the cost estimates that they developed for the barge-based treatment. They looked at the barge capital costs, the treatment unit capital costs, as well as the operating costs. And the significant thing that they determined here was that the tug operating costs required to move the barge into place for treatment were the largest contributor to the overall life cycle cost of the approach, which was around $10 million over its 20-year life cycle. Hilliard looks at the Caspian shipping region, in particular vessels transiting between the Black Sea to the Caspian Sea, and looks at the specific ballasting practices of these vessels to determine where the best location for a shore-based treatment facility might be in the region. So here's the port of Rostov-on-Don, which is the selected location for the facility. There are 240 vessels that travel to and from the region annually during its eight-month operating year. And the region sees around 300,000 metric tons of ballast water discharged annually. So for reference, this is about on scale of the El Segundo Marine Terminal in California. Typical vessels in this area are river sea ships, which is a term for the general cargo ships and tankers of the region that are dual-classed, have two design drafts for operating both in inland waterways and on open ocean transit. The capacities range anywhere from 500 to 2,300 metric tons per vessel. And again, the study looks at a shore-based treatment facility to serve the entire region with a storage capacity of 6,000 metric tons. So the primary research conducted in this study was distributing ballast water record forms to ships that transit from the Black Sea to the Caspian Sea via the route that I've highlighted above. And they found that these ships will actually discharge ballast en route at multiple points to meet draft requirements. And for this reason, they need to treat the ship before it reaches these points so that they're not discharging invasive species in the canal and in the Caspian region. There's a natural set of locks just past the port of Rostov-on-Don that naturally inhibits invasive species from moving between. The most important conclusion of the study is that pre-arrival vessel operations are a very important factor in determining the feasibility of shore-based treatment. And finally, by using a high storage capacity, the treatment facility has flexibility in its operations to accept higher ballast water volumes or during periods of treatment system inactivity. Next study I'll look at is Pereira, which looks at two major iron ore ports in Brazil and uses a discrete event simulation model to model the port cargo operations and treatment operations and determine the minimum treatment rate and storage capacity necessary to serve all the vessels calling to these ports. An overview of one of the ports, the Port of Tubarão. The Port of Tubarão receives upwards of 600 annual vessel calls, and the Port of Sepetiba a little under 200 vessel calls per year, with 27 million metric tons of ballast water discharged and 7.5 metric tons of ballast water discharged annually, respectively. And just for reference, the Port of Sepetiba receives roughly twice that of the annual ballast water discharged at the Port of Long Beach here in California. So the ports receive very large iron ore carriers with ballast water capacities from 12,000 to 120,000 metric tons. And it looks at using a shore-based facility to treat the vessels at both facilities. So just kind of a quick background on the discrete event simulation. The study just develops a particular logic for every operation that the vessel undergoes at port, from berthing to the treatment and cargo operations to the unberthing step. So the model looks at various variables. So ship arrives at port. The model asks if there's a port of it, if there's a berth available, if there's favorable weather, if the channel is free, and this logic follows on down the line for the entire process. And each of these variables is modeled against real data that they collected at the port to validate the model. So So once they validated typical port operations, they then introduce treating the ship's ballast water into the model and determine the minimum treatment rate and storage capacity necessary to attend all of these ships without increasing the time the vessels spend in port. So Pereira doesn't look in detail at vessel modifications and simply assumes that the rate of ballast water transfer is equal to the pump capacity on the vessels in the study. And for port logistics, the main conclusion is that the discrete event simulation is a useful tool for modeling these treatment operations at ports, especially in the absence of a real-world example to look at. And also it can be used as a predictive model. So the study, once they find the minimum treatment rate and capacity necessary to serve the region, then they look at what would happen if the ships or if the port started receiving calls from much larger ships with higher ballast water volumes to determine if they can still serve all of the vessels without increasing their capacity. And so they found that with a 5,000 metric ton per hour treatment rate and 40,000 metric tons storage capacity, they can serve all 600 vessels calling the major port of Tubarão metric tons per vessel call. So this is much smaller scale than the previous studies that looked at. Typical vessels at the port of Espierre are ro-ro freight ferries, general cargo ships, offshore service platform vessels, and that receive very dedicated calls. So these vessels are on dedicated routes between specific ports in the region, whereas the port of Fredericia gets more random vessel calls from a larger subset of vessels. Treatment approach is considered as a mobile unit. So this is what the study calls just having a treatment system mounted on a truck trailer that can be hooked up to a truck and driven around the port, a barge-based treatment system, and then reusing treated ballast water. In both cases, UV filtration is the technology selected for the treatment approaches, and it considers treating ballast water at a rate such that no storage capacity is necessary. Here's a table showing all of the six cases. Just want to talk about some of the variables that they modulate here to get a range of options. They look at treating ships at the port of Espierre and at the port of Fredericia, and also treating a specific fleet of vessels at the port of Espierre and all associated ports that these vessels call to. So whenever one of these vessels travels to a port, it knows that there's a treatment system that can treat its ballast water. And then it looks at two different treatment methods, again, the mobile unit, the barge, and also using the mobile units to provide treated ballast water to vessels. And finally, the study takes an interesting approach to looking at the scope of services and considers having a third party conduct ballast water treatment operations. So, for example, a stevedoring company, which already performs cargo operations at a port, could expand their business services to also conduct treatment operations. And they find that in conversation with the stevedoring companies at these ports, there was some interest in taking this on. So ultimately, the goal of the study was to develop the costs for each of these scenarios in terms of treatment costs per call and per metric ton of ballast water treated. And without going through point by point, I think the main thing to take away from their cost of estimates were that the crucial factor was treating a large volume of ballast water with a relatively few number of treatment systems and minimizing capital costs. The highest cost per call here is for scenario A4, which is the barge-based approach. And they found that the capital investment of the barge significantly raised the price compared to using a truck trailer. Another significant finding of the study was that discharge locations are best located both on the port and starboard sides of the vessel. This accommodates for vessels to berth in different configurations at different ports. And also they should be located near the stern of the vessel. In conversations with stevedoring companies, they found this was the best way to not interfere with cargo loading operations. The study also suggests examining regulations applicable to disposing the filtrate from the treatment process. So in the first filtering step in the treatment process, there's some filtrate left over, and the regulations may change depending on the region of how to dispose of that filtrate. It's 282 annual vessel calls and around 8 million metric tons of ballast water discharge annually, similar to the scale of the port of Sepetiba, about twice that of the port of Long Beach annually. The study estimates that around 50 vessels a year will require contingency treatment in the early days of the regulatory regime. And the main vessel type looked at here is bulkers, which was found to be the main discharger of ballast water at the port of Milwaukee. And a higher-end estimate for the ballast water capacity the study makes on these vessels is 70,000 metric tons. Again, the treatment approach uses a barge-based contingency treatment with UV filtration, and it does not consider having significant ballast water storage on the vessels. So King's study takes a look at the cost estimates in terms of annual fixed costs and annual variable costs, and determines that the annualized life cycle cost for the barge-based approach is around $900,000 a year. And you see that over 300,000 of these costs are from variable costs, and all of those costs are tugboat services in moving the barge into place at the different terminals to treat the ships. So again, this is another example of tug operations being one of the highest contributors to the cost estimate. The study updates cost estimates made in Glaston 2002 of the vessel modification costs for different types of ships. And on the lower end, is a grain ship would be $137,000, and on the upper end, a tanker is around $2.4 million. So again, the size and the type of ship makes a huge difference in how much it costs to modify a vessel to use shore-based approaches. The main conclusion on port logistics is that the terminals at the Port of Baltimore are very dispersed. There are around 8 terminals at the port that bulkers call to, and there are a wide array around the port, and so it costs a lot of money for the tugs to move the barge around. And this is why this is such a high contributor to the life cycle cost. And finally, it's an uncertainty of demand for contingency treatment, though the study says maybe in the first year of ballast water regulations, there will be 50 vessels that either won't have a shipboard treatment system or will have a malfunctioning treatment system. It's very hard to predict what this number is going to be in the future, which makes the economic feasibility of a contingency approach very uncertain. The last study I'll talk about is the ballast water treatment boat study, which looks at two very large shipping regions, the Asia-Oceania shipping region and the European shipping region, and looks to see for all of these vessels that call only to ports within these regions, how many treatment vessels or ballast water treatment boats will it take to serve these, and is this number far less than the number of vessels or the number of shipboard treatment units that would be needed to serve the vessels in a shipboard regime. So the study looks at all vessels over greater than or equal to 400 gross tons in both regions, so any vessel for which the IMO Ballast Water Convention is applicable. Analysis, which is performed for Region 2, looks at vessel routes over a 6-month period and is trying to determine how many vessels are only calling to ports in this region over the 6-month period. How many are truly regional, and so how many vessels are we needing to treat with these ballast water treatment boats? The study finds that a little under 16,000 vessels operate strictly regionally in Region 2, which is the European region. For the detailed analysis, they examine a representative subset of vessel routes over a 6-year period, so they have more certainty over which vessels are strictly regional in this period of time. Then they look at a representative subset of ports that are called by these vessels, find the times at which the ports experience maximum demand from the regional vessels, and determine how many ballast water treatment boats are necessary to serve these ports during periods of maximum demand. And this will give, looking at the whole scale of the region, the total number of ballast water treatment boats necessary. For Region 1, they found that more than 18,000 vessels operated strictly regionally in the region, and only 2,400 ballast water treatment boats would be necessary to serve this region. Relevant findings. For vessel modifications, the study suggests adopting the oil company's International Marine Forum standards and guide to ship-to-ship transfer to interface the vessels with the treatment barges. And for port logistics, they find that ballast water treatment boats can not only perform treatment operations, but could also serve as sediment reception facilities for ports requiring that service. And finally, the main conclusion of the study is that shore-based treatment approaches may offer an advantage of scale. For a very, very large number of vessels that need to be treated, a relatively few number of treatment systems could be implemented to serve these vessels. And now I'll pass things off to Kevin Reynolds. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Rusty. As Rusty was showing, there's quite an interesting and diverse body of literature out there. And our team, working with getting feedback from Delta Stewardship Council, getting feedback from EPA, and frankly, even the IMO, said, yeah, it seems like we have the relevant literature within a 10-year period. And those six studies that we looked at were what had good original research on the topic. How do we get the ballast water off the vessel, or in some cases, frankly, bring infrastructure from shore to the vessel to take care of this ballast water challenge that's facing us? A theme, I hope you picked it up there and handed out this double-sided table. As you look at this table, it's just remarkable how different the scope and scale and volumes and vessel types are in all these different regions. And as we look at California, you see the same thing. The Port of Hueneme is not the Port of Stockton, and it's not L.A. Long Beach. These are very different aspects here. So if that's one take-home message, it's look at this great set of literature that's quite broad. Look at these six studies and see, one, what were the very different analytical methods that they used. We cruise along here. We have, for Hilliard, 280,000 metric tons of ballast water discharged in a year. I would guess this room here has on the order of about maybe 400 metric tons, so just for maybe 500, just for scope. We move over to Pereira, 27 million metric tons, so 280,000 compared to 27 million. If my math is correct, that's a 1,000x factor. So please take away that this is quite different in the different studies. And what we're looking at here is California, which is just an incredibly diverse state. I'll pick up on the themes of vessel modifications, port logistics, and treatment approaches, taking what Rusty's presented and saying, hey, what are the collected lessons learned between the different studies, and how do we apply that to California? So in terms of vessel modifications, again, I'm going to stay on this table in front of you. On the reverse side, the one that's kind of gray, table 13, we look at Brown and Caldwell. For their small vessel, they're looking at a modification of $60,000 for Brown and Caldwell, the small vessel at 5,700 metric ton. The large vessel at $220,000 for 17,800 metric tons. So that's about a 3x factor. Think about Pereira and their 120,000 metric ton discharges. What's the cost of that modification going to be? So one big lesson from there for vessel mods, it's going to depend a great deal on the vessel. When you look at small car carriers, you look at container ships, they don't do a lot of ballasting. They have some ability to manage their ballast water when they're going to discharge. They don't always have to do it in lockstep with their cargo operations. You look like in Pereira with the large bulkers, while they're discharging, while they're taking on cargo, they have to discharge that ballast water at the same time to maintain stability. So two very different operations. That has very significant impact on vessel modification, practicality, and cost. Reliable connection. Imagine we have this perfect shore-based ballast treatment technology and we can't get the water there practically. This reliable connection, this link between the vessel and this, whether it's barge or truck or land-based facility, making that connection is non-trivial. What if we have, we meet the highest possible standard, but it's a leaky connection? That's something to think about. Think about oil spills during bunkering operations or even cargo transfers. Those happen. This reliable connection is quite a challenge. The other piece there is there are alternative capture methods. So barge comes up alongside, the mechanical arm attaches to the hull of the ship by magnets, a bladder inflates, and then they're attached and they're pulling the ballast water off the ship. This is a concept. We haven't seen any practical demonstrations, but again, that's one of the TOPFLOW is one of the 30 documents, not one of the key six. In reviewing the literature, in-depth study of the six informed by the additional 30, and that's an interesting concept, these sort of things. How do we get the water from the vessel to the treatment process, shore-based support? Port logistics. King is quite helpful in how King talks about, we've got this 8 million tons of ballast water to manage. There's a lot of infrastructure in place in the Port of Baltimore. However, the locations of where this bulk cargo is discharged is spread around the port quite significantly. So the getting the extent and expense of port infrastructure in the Port of Baltimore is driven by that diverse location. If we look at Port of Stockton in California here, it's quite different. We'll take a look and we'll see the studies that Peter will talk about. It's quite close in. Getting port infrastructure there, maybe pipelines or other shore-based, land-based infrastructure makes sense. King looked at the diversity of the logistics in all the locations and said, we need a barge to chase these vessels in these ballast water discharges. Brown and Caldwell, in their phase one study, originally was looking at land-based using pipelines. And by the time they got to phase two, they said, that doesn't seem practical to us. We need to go with this mobile approach, using barges not only for the storage, but also for containing the treatment equipment itself. They found that to be a match. But again, don't confuse Brown and Caldwell, very different location in Milwaukee compared to King, very diverse set of areas in Baltimore. As we look at California, it's quite interesting to see we have Milwaukee's and we have Baltimore's. There's this concept, not a concept, but there's this reality, but we don't know the extent of vessels having to discharge ballast water while underway. How much are they preparing for cargo operations at the berth? In other words, before they arrive at a berth to start transferring cargo, which typically is the time when they'll be transferring ballast water, are they lightening up a little on their ballast water before they get there? Are they taking ballast water to get air drafts down so they could get under bridges? Water drafts up so they can get above shallows. We don't have a good understanding. It's identified in the literature as something that needs more research. We'll talk about even doing oceanographic research and science study. Can I get a vessel safely and efficiently into a port and out of a port? And now we're introducing a new element here that needs careful consideration. How are we going to manage the ballast water using shore-based infrastructure? So just what are those considerations? Several of the studies, notably Pereira, talks about how using storage facilities is just a very practical tool. With the surges, they have this numerical model where they see the surges of ballast water in influx into the port and then quiet times where the vessel is left. So rather than sizing all the equipment to meet the maximum instantaneous ballast water discharge from the vessels, imagine three vessels all at 5,000 cubic meters per hour at the same time. They're saying we can use surge tanks so that way we don't have to size it for the max instantaneous, but we can kind of average it over a couple days. So very important lesson from the literature there. There's not, in these studies, there's not a lot of detailed discussion about treatment processes themselves. So this literature is very focused on how we get the water from the vessels, how we deal with port logistics, and transfer it to shore-based facilities. There's not a lot of discussion on the treatment process. There is some discussion that considers boy, if we knew what the salinity of the water was all the time, we could tune the technology for it. If we knew what the UV transmittance was, we could also tune the technology. We could identify oxidant demands. We could identify these characteristics and really get it just right. What they found is it's not so practical. Just because the vessel's in Stockton doesn't mean they're discharging fresh water. It's where the vessel came from, whether that's Washington State, whether it's Mexico, whether it's somewhere in China. That's the source water. So having a reliable understanding of what that water is so we can tune our process, that's a challenge. We might not get there. On the treatment approaches, we'll try to hammer these through, just so trying to, a little pounding, you'll eventually sink in. First one there is new land-based treatment facilities. Our challenge, what we're seeing there, King talks about it a fair bit, is when we transfer the ballast water off the marine vessel, it's not ballast water anymore. So what is it? What is that complex characteristics or regulatory regime that we need to be concerned with? Is it now wastewater? Is it what are the rules that are going to restrict how we handle it? Clearly, we're going to want to meet this California interim standard. We're going to want the highest possible to determine how can we or can we use that infrastructure. Cowie, in particular, talks about some of the salinity challenges. They've looked, so this is a Northern European study. They looked at their existing wastewater treatment plant infrastructure, and they said the salinity is too high. It's not compatible with the piping systems, and it's not compatible with the processes. So it's not saying that we'll find the same thing here in California, but they have some items that we need to pay careful attention to in using existing wastewater treatment plants. On reception and reuse, we have this concept that we can provide ballast water to a vessel that's already been treated, and then they can go to a location and now they can discharge it. So Hilliard looked at that at some significant extent. Their concept was they're really trading ballast water between vessels headed to the Caspian Sea and then returning from the Caspian Sea. It sounds good. The challenge that we need to think about there is who's going to certify the water? So, and what's the motivation for the operations in the source location? Again, whether it's Washington, Mexico, or China, what's the motivation to have that expense to provide that ready for discharge water, pre-treated water, for now being received in California? So we've got some lessons that have been identified for us, both on, you know, understanding that the water is suitable and how do we get that motivation so that pre-treatment is available and accepted. Mobile treatment approaches. So this is a increasing theme. As we look at older studies, more than 10 years old, most of those focus on land-based fixed infrastructure. As we did the filtering to look at the last 10 years, the overwhelming trajectory has been towards mobile facilities. As I take a look at table 12, that's the blue one here, and I look at the bottom blue line that's called treatment system, starting from the left, Brown and Caldwell is barge, Hilliard is land-based facility, skipping to Cowie looks at truck and barge, King at barged, and BWT boat is self-propelled barge. So quite a trajectory there, suggesting that this flexibility of logistics, this ability of bringing at least the storage, the capture and storage, if not capture, storage, and treatment to the marine vessels, offers some significant advantages in terms of logistics. A few additional items, not strictly in the get the water off the vessel, how do we safely and efficiently get the vessel in and out of port, and then do we do it in an existing plant, a new plant, a mobile facility? Some supplemental considerations that rang through an important aspect of who's going to do the work, what's their motivation, how is it practical, economically interesting to those groups to do the work. Shore-based contingency. So BWT Boat talks about it somewhat. King addresses it straight on. This is this idea that a vessel that should, under certain regulatory regimes, be arriving with the ability to discharge managed ballast water, whether it was pre-treated on uptake, perhaps even exchanged and retreated during transit, and then treatment again on discharge, whatever the combination of on-the-vessel discharge, something's happened. They didn't install it. They missed a deadline. Operator mistake. Some equipment broke down. Now what do you do? So King looks at this in an extent, and he says, of all the 200-some-odd discharges in Baltimore, we're throwing a dart and saying maybe 50 of them in early years will need a contingency. They show up and they say, we're sorry, something happened. We're not able to discharge properly managed water. The challenge with that is it's awfully uncertain. Think back to that third-party stevedore who's counting on some revenue from each one of these discharges, and it turns out that rather than 50, he gets 5. That's a consideration. So on this contingency is quite interesting. Repurposing of treated ballast water. There's discussion of using this water and sending it to desalination plants, sending the filtrate to landfills. Just what are the extra uses that can we turn this ballast water that's being viewed as a threat into some sort of an asset? Is there some opportunity here? So our takeaways here are one size doesn't fit all. Long Beach is not Port Hueneme. Does anybody know El Segundo at all? A little bit, yeah. So El Segundo, it's quite interesting. It's an offshore marine terminal. It's about 4.5-5 miles off of, I want to say, Redondo Beach. The tank vessels arrive there offshore. They're within sight of land, but fairly far out. And they take on and discharge cargo, liquid petroleum cargoes, with the El Segundo refinery. They discharge ballast water in those cargo evolutions in very significant volumes. It's a fairly steady operation. There's, I have to look at my list, but I want to say it's something on the order of 80 to 100 ballast water discharges in a year. That is very, very different than Port Hueneme, which is quite a small port. 1-2 docks quite close together with their ballast water discharges. Volumes are quite small. So one size doesn't fit all. As we look at this, we need to really consider, improve and mature that document and release it. We will talk a bit this afternoon about the case study approach, how we've tried to consider what we've learned in this literature review and how we're thinking about the state of California on identifying 6 case studies that try to capture this depth and breadth of variety of vessels and port logistics and treatment approaches that can inform us on scaling up to the entire state. And then the next biggest step is actually doing that scale up and digging into some of these additional details. So my sincere thanks particularly to Peter and Rusty for a lot of work trying to synthesize this information to make it relevant to California, and I hand it to, I think, George, and that's a conclusion of our presentation on the literature.
Thank you, Kevin. We'll spend the next 10 or 15 minutes with questions and clarifications from the panel. Following that, we'll take a 10 or 15-minute break, and then we'll come back, and the panel would have some final comments.
So I'll lead off with a couple of questions, Bill Cooper. One question is, How much work did you find about actually characterizing ballast water? In other words, we know there's a difference between the salinity, that's pretty trivial, but are there other things that we need to be considering when discharging this ballast water? So did you find anything at all about actually the water quality of the ballast water?
The literature studies specifically on this shore-based ballast treatment don't go into a lot of detail on the water quality. Some of the supplemental documents, particularly California State Lands Commission reports, quite helpful is the U.S. EPA and U.S. Coast Guard put together a combined effort called the Environmental Technology Verification Program, which is how do you test ballast water treatment systems. That effort probably gives us the best idea of what sort of what's called in that terms challenge water, what that water quality would look like. They've pulled together scientists from basically from around the world, meet quite routinely. I'm on that group, and they look at things such as turbidity, dissolved organic carbon, total particulate organic carbon, different characteristics of the water. And their motto, if you would, is they're looking for challenging but not rare conditions for ballast water. So not directly in the literature that talks about shore-based, but in the periphery documents, there is quite helpful information on that challenge conditions.
So they have a subcommittee specifically looking at ballast water.
But these studies didn't go into a lot of detail on the treatment technologies, but it would be, I think, useful to have a little bit more information because all filters don't work the same. Sometimes you need to use chemicals to really make the filters perform well. I was also wondering if you came across anything on cross-contamination. It seems like as you're putting different water sources through these stable treatment systems, they could accumulate or be inoculated by organisms from different places. And I was reminded I worked on the pretreatment for desalination in Tampa Bay a few years ago, and so there was a filter that was used for the pretreatment, and one of the things that happened is it got colonized by Asian green mussels, which weren't native, and so even in the backwashing process and in the managing of the filters, that still colonized the filter to the extent that it created a pathway through there. So it would be useful in this literature review to have a little bit more detail. Same thing with the UV, which you mentioned a fair amount. Not all UV systems can handle the salinity or the organics, and then just the reliability. So, you know, I know that you said there wasn't much in these studies, but it might be useful to at least pull together. And there's a fair amount of literature out there in scattered places that might be relevant.
Right. We in discussion with Delta Stewardship Council, we thought about going. I mean, there's talk about a vast body of literature on treatment processes. It's 100 years of literature on different treatment processes and their efficacy and applicability. So luckily, task five for us is on treatment processes that have promise for meeting the California interim standard. So we'll take a look in the literature review and see if maybe we can make that more clear or see what there is. But unfortunately, we did focus on getting the water from the vessel to the treatment process. But fortunately, task five, it's all about the treatment process. And maybe I hand it to Jean, who can, you know, just kind of what's envisioned there. How will you incorporate existing literature and information into doing that task five, which is all about the treatment process?
But I guess, yeah, I mean, I realize that that's a separate test, but I guess the point is that the cost estimates are based on these technologies. And so it seems like even in what you reviewed, it just sort of left kind of, it was a little bit arm wavy, that section of it, I guess, was kind of my point.
We'll dig into that particularly a little bit, but the those studies, they were waving their arms on the treatment processes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, okay.
I don't know if I have too much to add on that, but other than it's coming, it's down the road.
Okay.
We're going to look at that.
Yes. Go ahead.
Kevin and Rusty, you did a great job trying to find papers that don't. These were pretty detailed. Some said, well, we included only domestic ships. Some said we included only foreign ships or flags of our state, flag state ships in the region, that sort of thing. So I don't know that I didn't get a feeling that all ships were covered in all of these studies. It just didn't appear that maybe they were. But obviously, going forward, you have a very difficult task, too, coming up. And I think it's going to be shown in there. The other thing that I believe is very important is the quantity of the ballast that is being discharged. And again, not to digress into the studies, but I think there's an awful lot that has to be analyzed when going forward in your task, too, as to what quantities of ballast are really being discharged in the ports that we're interested in. And probably one of the biggest things that bothered me the most was the pump characteristics and the ship's pumping capability and capacity. I think you and I have a very strong understanding that I'm not aware of any ships that can pump to shoreside today. I'm not sure that there's ballast pump capacities built into ships. There may be a few ships that have that capacity, but generally a ship pump design is not designed to pump ashore. So when we say in the studies that the pumps appear to be adequate to pump ashore, I think that has to be demonstrated quite clearly. And I think, again, in task two, I think you've got a very serious challenge to show how what's going to happen to a ship. And the retrofit cost for those ships wasn't very well defined in any of these studies. I think you covered carefully the ship locations in ports. The group of studies you had showed the diversity, and you fully recognized that that can be a very serious issue. Some of these ports may be 10, 15 miles, docks may be 10 or 15 miles apart. So one of the other items that I have is what happens to the discharge of the backwash if you're doing filters or the effluent or the contaminated waste, whether it's in a storage facility or being treated on the barge or treated in a shoreside facility. So those are just a few of the observations. We've very clearly said that we want zero tolerance for leakage. I'm suggesting that we really need zero tolerance for the number of ships that are included as well. In other words, all the ships have to be included. There's a in taking a look at this. So those are my comments to you.
Really appreciate that, Rick. Quite insightful. I'm going to try and address a couple of them, and then I'm going to ask Rusty and Peter and John to help out a little bit. So this is a great question, and particularly the first one. Where do we draw the line? I suggest that we're going to use the California State Lands Commission line, do carry ballast water. So where do you want to draw that line right there? Right now, we're on the path of following that line as drawn for California State Lands Commission on commercial vessels. But great question, Rick, because the organisms from a recreational vessel or from a vessel that's below that 400 gross ton size, they're the same organism as the one that's 1 ton above. The pump capacities, yeah, so Rick and I are both merchant mariners, both chief engineers who've run numerous ships actually in the bilges, traveling the world in the United States, moving cargo and people and even bombs during military campaigns. And we know what these pumps can do. They're designed as very low head pumps for the most part. They're taking water that's typically simply gravitated in because you want stability down low in the vessel. So often the sea is higher than the area you're filling in the vessel. And when you're pumping it out, you don't have to pump very far. The idea of pumping it up to a hill is quite challenging. We worked quite a bit on that in 2002 when we did a study for the Port of Seattle, and people just about fell out of their chairs when they saw us say, hey, that's $2 million for a tanker. And the answer was, that's because we have to redo the entire pumping system. And those particular vessels started discharging long before they got to the dock. So now they no longer needed to, say, go at a rate of 2,000 cubic meters an hour. They had to make up. So they had to redo the entire piping plant to go to 3,000 cubic meters an hour, because in that case, the metric was, don't slow down the current cargo operation. So very interesting, Rick, and we'll hit that one pretty hard on task two. So let me push it first to Peter. And so, Peter, the question that Rick had there was, how do we make sure that we get reliable numbers on what the number of vessels discharging in California were and what those ballast water quantities were, so that we're not mistaking or inadvertently missing vessels from this study?
Yeah, thanks very much, Rick, for your comments and your questions. That's the one that I can speak to. And fortunately for our study, the National Ballast Information Clearinghouse keeps detailed records on ballast water discharges in the state of California and, in fact, in all 50 states. And it's broken down by port, and so it's a convenient place for us to mine data that will inform the study going forward. It's a great tool. So that's actually a very straightforward problem to wrap our heads around, but an important one.
Very good, yes. Thank you. In one note to add, State Lands Commission also corroborates data. I say corroborate because they have it's interesting. Some of the sources are similar in that a vessel will send a report to State Lands Commission and send a report to this national database. So they're independent database too. And because it's so fine and these volumes are so large, these are typically, you're looking at lots of different filtration technologies, but some of them do a lot of back flushing. You have to deal with this debris that you catch that could have something like green mussels or other unintended pieces there. So Rusty, what does the literature say? And then Jean, what are you thinking about this?
Sure. So this is a great question, and really CAWI is the only study that looks at it in any detail. And so there's kind of two things that need to be dealt with, and it's so the filtrate would be treated maybe with some solution, say a chlorine solution, and then you'll have a supernatant liquid that needs to be disposed of and also the sediment at the bottom after treatment. And the study considers sending the supernatant liquid back to sea, but notes that the regulations here are not clear, and it's going to be really dependent on the region. And same for the sediment. Could possibly go to a landfill. There aren't really any clear guidance on the regulations.
Yeah, I'm just going to add that the organisms are one end of it, but I can see that a much bigger deal as far as volumetrically is the sediments that are associated with the waters, depending upon where the water comes from, and then the settling rates, what the characteristics of these sediments, how you're going to settle those, how you're going to dry those, how you're going to handle those. I mean, the volumes could be very, very large and very, very different between different waters that are collected. I'm not as familiar on the marine side of things, but on the land base, when you're dealing with the domestic waters and things, that's a challenge, and it's significant volumes, you know, up to 5 to upwards to 8% of the flow of the water. So something that we need to look at specifically. And then the supernatant, there could be another disinfection process there to deal with any residual organisms that made it through or that needs to be looked at clearly in the treatment section. So.
Thank you, Kevin.
Great. Thank you.
One of the thank you for those responses, and very good. You're right. The National Ballast Information Clearinghouse has all that information. I had forgotten that. I think obviously the big challenge too is, and mostly in task two, is matching the high flow ballast and loading capacities of some of the ships that you do have. I'm certain are going to be high capacity pumps and high capacity loading rates. So again, when we talk about discharging to a ballast ship or a truck, we really have to be careful that we can match those I noted in one study there was a talk about, I think in Cowie it says 300 metric tons per hour was the ballast discharge rate, and the ship time was 1 hour, 50 minutes, close to an hour, which is 79,000 gallons, and that's 10 tank trucks in an hour that you have to load and get out of the
blessed with a lot of diversity. And when you look at the port complexes, when we've mentioned L.A., Long Beach, and certainly just within that, those two complexes themselves, there's a lot of diversity. The large volumes is certainly something that you would have to consider, and if it's you're taking it to land, we mentioned surge tank capacity and finding spaces at a premium in all of these facilities. So how do you find a place to put it, minimize the tenant's operations, the operators? I mean, that's always a primary concern, is how are you affecting my business? And certainly looking at ways to do that. And we're talking about things of new treatment plants. Where do you put those? How do you convey the ballast water to those? Those are certainly going to be a challenge. And then you look at smaller places like Port Hueneme was talked about. And, you know, that's part of the reason that Kevin asked me to be on the team, is that I've worked at a lot of these facilities. So I have a fairly good understanding of what infrastructure is there, and know the folks at those facilities to talk to them about, you know, what kind of ideas that, you know, I think talking with them and getting their perspective and some of the operators is going to be a key consideration when we go into the study, so that we can present things that the end users will find viable as well.
Yeah, it's not until you get into the details. You got to go into those details. What's the pump look like on that ship? Really? That's really going to go into that tanker truck? And how are you going to turn that on and off in such a time that it's not going to spill all over? So when it's task three is port and wharf refit, and in there the rubber's going to kind of meet the ballast will meet the land or something like that. Having KPFF on the team and their experience in refitting an awful lot of port infrastructure is going to be helpful. But the literature does tend to glance over it quite a bit, Rick.
Thank you very much for those answers.
I want to just remind everyone that this is a great dialogue going on. It's a very rich conversation. But let's take a quick break here and come back and continue the conversation. I'm pretty sure there's more panel members that have questions.
Okay, are we all set back on record? Okay, great. Thank you very much. And that was a good break.
...of demand for ballast water treatment. And I realize that part of that has to do with the condition of onboard treatment, as well as fluctuations in ships that make a call in California. So I think that will be really interesting, and I'm looking forward to that. I'm interested in small port issues, in particular, you know, how what the enterprise model will be and the source of financing to get appropriate treatment capital put together for places such as, for example, the Port of Humboldt that gets relatively intermittent ships making a call at that port. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve, for those pieces there. And nicely, we have King and Associates on our group. And boy, Dennis is did a great job, we thought, with that Baltimore study and thinking about some of those aspects. And we will be very mindful of locations like Humboldt and trying to understand that they are quite different in how we make sure that they wouldn't get left behind, or at least to understand those implications. So appreciate that comment.
Thank you. Christine.
Yes.
Thank you. As a segue to what Rick was talking about and what Steve is talking about here, it seems to me that I don't want us to just be looking backward at what has been done, and that there are a lot of changes out there in terms of plans for more shipboard activity. The LNG issue up Pacific Northwest is big. And I think for any of these studies to be germane to the future planning, that we need some information from the planners, what's on the horizon, and then of course you've got a whole section in your contract about the regulatory arena, but I really think that's my biggest problem of lacking with this, is that we can't just look back at the past, and we have to do some futuring. So those are some general comments, and I could give you more specifics, but there's a lot of things going on right now in the economy.
Thank you for that comment, Christine. And it is our intent as we go through these to be future-looking, but similar to what Rick noted, which is making sure that we're not leaving vessels off. That's another thing I think we need to talk about with Delta Stewardship Council, is which models, making sure we spend an appropriate amount of time so that we don't assess what would work in 2008 as opposed to 2030.
If they're using chlorine, they'll chlorinate and then dechlorinate, so that's well documented. With respect to infrastructure, too, having worked at a couple of wastewater treatment plants often have extra million-gallon tanks running around. Not running around, but they're on location. So it may be when you start looking at infrastructure, and if there is a wastewater treatment plant around where the port is, there may be some additional storage that's easy to access. And this, I think we all know that one size won't fit all, but is there any way, and I think the answer to this question is no, but is there any way to classify the ships, maybe by port, but looking at the different kinds of ships? The two that I was working on were 850-foot oil tankers, so they would take on about 40,000 metric tons of ballast water, which, by the way, a good way of talking to the audience about people that don't know what 40,000 tons is, that's the weight of the steel in the Eiffel Tower. So that gives you an idea of how much water ships are taking, these 850-foot ballast water ships. Again, that gives you a visual to kind of think of what on earth is 40,000 metric tons of water. So is there any way of classifying ships? I mean, so that we can get a handle on it gets kind of back to Rick's question, I guess. And you don't have to answer that. It's just something.
Yeah, obviously, chlorine, it's been around for, 100 years, and it's got a lot of uses. It's the good thing about it is we know the drawbacks, right? The vast majority of the drawbacks we know. Sure, there's some disinfection byproducts out there on the horizon, but it's reliable. It's so well used. And then the additional storage at the wastewater treatment plant, definitely noted. There typically is, but it's a problem with capacity when during high flow periods is the real problem. Vast majority of the time, there's lots of capacity, and then a short amount of time, there's no capacity. And that's the real challenge with and without ballast water.
Right, absolutely. Audrey, do you have any questions further?
I like the idea of future scenarios. I think that's a really important point, to really be more future, maybe come up with some different scenarios for each port that might make sense. And the other thing, I don't remember if I said this before, is just what about cross-contamination? If you have storage on shore and you're bringing water in from different locations, it seems like you could inoculate or cross-contaminate. So I don't know if that's been covered in the studies before, but it might be just something to pay attention to in terms of what you would monitor or how you would know, transfer the water between different boats or ships and things.
Got to defer to you, Bill. There's so much good material here. We'll just keep receiving. If you want more responses, let us know. Yeah.
Well, we're going to be preparing a report, so there'll be a time to kind of, condense all this down so we can, document
like,
it.
Like on a cross-contamination, even Peter Soles was mentioning, you can always know what you're going to get.
That's right. Christine.
Oh, I would just like to ask our late arriving consultant to introduce himself to the group. Thank you.
Thank you, Christine, for the opportunity. And I apologize that I was late. I went to the 13th floor, and they didn't know where I was supposed to be, and so I stood out front and tried to get a hold of all these folks who weren't answering their phones because they were in front of you good folks. So I stood outside for a little while until I figured out that I needed to be 300 feet away inside this building. So thank you. My name is Ross Dunning. I'm also with Kennedy Jenks Consultants. I work with Jean. I am the company's stormwater practice leader, and I work primarily for ports. Well, one of the things that I do is work with ports across the country, all of them in the Pacific Northwest, and Oakland, and Long Beach, and a few on the East Coast currently. Providing assistance with NPDES regulations, so Clean Water Act regulations, how to comply with them, how they interact between industrial and municipal discharges. And in the Pacific Northwest, we're doing a lot of work retrofitting existing facilities to meet stormwater regulations that are different than anywhere else in the world. People in the Northwest, ports in the Northwest, are spending millions of dollars to retrofit their existing facilities to provide stormwater treatment. I won't yet be the ghost of Christmas future about how I think that that's going to apply in California in the coming decade, but I do think that's valuable. I bring that experience from the Northwest to this panel. Let's see. And also, I just wanted to add that I also work a lot with the folks at KPFF. They do a lot of infrastructure work. We do a lot of stormwater work, sanitary work. So we work together quite a bit. And so we've got a good working knowledge as a team of what infrastructure exists and what it would take to, as far as modifications, to meet the regulations coming down the pike.
Great. Thank you very much. Steve.
Thank you, Bill. So touching on the issue of modeling demand and related to that, this is what's interesting about this type of a situation is that you have a regulation-induced enterprise, essentially, that we're contemplating creating, which is shoreside treatment. And so consequently, issues such as compliance have a big role to play in terms of estimating demand. And I know Dennis King has done some research looking at compliance within commercial fishing industry, and I think that...
Just one more that I had on my notes, Kevin, that I had missed. The source water, obviously, you're going to get also from the ballast water clearinghouse, and obviously that, as going to what Audrey had asked about, is the bula base that's in the tanks. It's who knows where it's from. I mean, it can be a mixture of, as you suggested. So I did have that in my notes, and you know all about that anyway. So thank you.
I wouldn't mind commenting a little bit on some of what Steve's pushing there, and it's true. We need to be forward-looking, but in relevant case study is what's going on with shipboard ballast water treatment installations. It's... they're struggling with this IMO, International Maritime Organization, adopted a ballast water convention in 2004. So that's 11 years ago, and they haven't yet ratified that international convention. So what's happened is, in the interim, over the last 3-4 years, new vessels have been built with treatment systems that have been approved with what you could maybe call uncertain processes to processes that are in question. One of the things holding up the ratification is exactly what you mentioned, that how do you have a compliance monitoring and enforcement regime that's of high quality so that you know what you're going to get when it's being discharged. So the impacts on that economic model are very significant. It's so therefore the uptake or the installations, that market has been kind of stuttering for quite a long time because of that uncertainty. So your points are very well taken, and there's quite an interesting and overlapping related story there with the shipboard uptake in this uncertainty combined with the economics, combined with how do you monitor and enforce to know what you're going to get.
Sorry. We do have some time here for public comments, but if there aren't any, I think we should continue this rich dialogue that we're having now, which will be very useful. If you do have, please bring me a blue card.
On.
Yeah, make sure that you.
All right. I'm Karen McDowell. I'm with the San Francisco Estuary Partnership. I've been working on ballast water for a long time. I have a few comments. One, with the barge systems that looks like the newer studies are looking at, how many vessels that were coming in a year that hadn't been there the previous year or the previous year before that? So if they're needing to retrofit to use a shoreside treatment system, how can you expect a vessel coming in once every 5 years to do that, or how can they prepare to do that? Or if they go to Mexico or Canada, then the currents, you know, bring them back up here. So I think it's important to deal with those rare vessels. And I know you have all the data from the State Lands Commission, so you can look at the numbers on those rare vessels.
Yeah, those are two really good comments. I mean, they're highly relevant. And you're bringing up a really good point. The literature that was reviewed, in particular those six studies, they're really not thinking about the California interim standard, and they are thinking about technologies that would be scaled up from what is currently being promoted and used for shipboard technology. So when we look at the literature, that's what's there. When we go and we move to our additional tasks, we need to look far beyond that. We need to be looking at that task is how do you meet the California interim standard? And we'll be leaning a lot on Ross and John on what are those technologies? Is this scale up of this shipboard technologies, for lack of a better term, is that the right solution? Is that going to get us there, or do we need to be looking past that? In Brown and Caldwell's, quite interesting if you read their phase one, then their evolution into phase two on how they arrived at the solution there. And certainly the other big issue, it's quite economic, is how do you end up with, call it California qualified vessels, because they have done this outfitting, and then a vessel that has never come to California gets a cargo that means that they now come to California and they haven't been pre-outfitted. Just how does that work? So those are two interesting, quite important pieces. Thank you.
All right. That's all I have for now. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions from the public or the non-public? Anybody? I guess in that case, we can just continue. Maybe we should. Do you want to recycle here? Christine or Steve, would you like to ask another question? Did you get adequate answers? Or we've got a little time before lunch, right? We've got, according to my watch, about 23 minutes before 12 o'clock, if 12 is lunchtime. Okay, Christine said she's fine.
I really like a group called Northwest Innovations that is developing three methanol plants in the Northwest. right now. Methanol is used for to make everything from de-icing fluid, and it's used in plastics and that type of thing right now. In China, my understanding is that it's made from coal, and it's a very not efficient process. And I'll leave it at that. And so they're looking at making methanol from liquefied natural gas, which is a much cleaner process, much more efficient, much more environmentally friendly. And so they're proposing giant facilities in the Northwest. And so one of the things that I think is going to be relevant that for us to consider during this study that relates to that is that process, those types of facilities, they're going to be bringing barges from China back and forth, I mean, on a constant basis. So ballast water is going to be important. That type of facility also uses a huge amount of water and processes a huge amount of water. Also, I mentioned the stormwater regulations. In that scenario, we're looking at using stormwater as a resource, and potentially ballast water as well. So the whole integration of one water and dealing with multiple sources, multiple uses, and thinking towards the future, and again, nobody knows how precious water is better than California right now. Right. So
good.
I'm just very excited to get into that.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, this, maybe you can see it's a pretty excited team to dig into the issues, and there won't be resting back on old information. It's very, very much going to be trying to dig into, understand what the future growth is, how to handle that, and what the different waste streams might be.
Okay. Steve, do you have are you doing okay? Okay. Anybody else, Raider?
No, I just want to say there's no reason not to break early, beat the lunch crowd, and maybe come back a little early and have more time at the tail end.
Yeah, that's fine with me. Yeah, we've got another presentation. So why don't we, if there's no further public comment this morning, we can close the meeting and go to lunch. It's now 20 to 12. So we should be back by 10 to 12. I think that's plenty of time, right? 10 minutes for lunch? We eat fast in Washington. When do you want to start back up, George?
Quarter to one should be fine. I think it's about an hour now, right?
Is that okay with everybody?
Yes.
Okay, super. Let's do that then. Thank you very, very much for this exciting and eventful morning. Thank you.
And following that, we'll have the same format. We'll have an interaction with the panel and then public comment period.
Thanks a million, George. And a real interesting part of our approach here is to take a case study approach to this study. And what we're trying to do is find doable options for a collection of six different locations that dig into enough of the details to really let our team sink their teeth into it, to say what are the actual characteristics of the marine vessels calling at a particular place. Talk to the actual terminal operators and say, hey, this is what we're thinking about. This is what we think is practical here. Lend us your experience. Give us your feedback as to why this does work or what are the things that we didn't think about. And then thinking about the wastewater treatment plants, what's practical there? Actually working closely with them, lending our expertise, talking with the operators of those treatment plants or envisioning where it could physically go. Now, as Peter, I'll invite Peter to take the podium up there to give the presentation. So as Peter will go through, you'll see this amazing significant combinations when you take all the ports in California, all the different vessel types, and all the different possible treatment approaches. Again, an approach being a new facility, reusing an existing facility, some sort of reuse, or a mobile plant. So in these combinations, there's so many there, and then Peter will take us through what we're suggesting as good case studies that's going to give us relevant details that'll enlighten what's practical, what's feasible, what's actually doable. So, Peter, please.
Thank you, Kevin. Can you hear me okay? Okay, good afternoon. This is a brief presentation of our proposed case study approach to what we're calling the core assessment, which is tasks 2 through 5 of the feasibility study on shore-based ballast water reception and treatment in California. In short, the case study model involves developing detailed assessments of shore-based ballast water reception and treatment at specific locations and using the information discovered in that process to scale up to a reasonably accurate representation of statewide implementation. Okay, why case studies? If you count the LA Long Beach complex as a single port, California has 35 seaports. And there are 6. That makes over 1,000 possible combinations of location, vessel type, and treatment approach. So it's simply not practical to evaluate them all, at least not to any real level of detail that's meaningful. So the case study is a means of reducing this myriad of possible combinations into, as Kevin was saying, practical, achievable, and tangible assessments so that our team can work to provide realistic, costed, and carefully evaluated feedback to the study. So from this list of 35, our team identified 5 case study ports that we feel, when taken together, reasonably represent the diversity of maritime activity across the state of California. These are Stockton, Oakland, Port Hueneme, El Segundo, and Long Beach. These 5 ports scattered across the state collectively make up approximately 44% of all the ballast water discharges in the state of California. They're diverse in terms of their physical scale, in terms of the nature of their port operations, and in terms of the ballast water quantities and flow rates that they see on a regular basis. Some are frequented only by a single vessel type. Others see ship calls of virtually all types. Some have mixed-use terminals, some do not. So with these 5, we feel that we're hitting some of the most significant ports in the state in terms of cargo volumes and the number of vessel calls, as well as some smaller ports with more modest volumes and less frequent calls. So we have 5 very different locations, and with these 5 case studies, we can pair each one with one of the 5 treatment approaches, so new on-site wastewater treatment plant, a new off-site treatment plant, and again, existing treatment plant, and 2 different mobile solutions. So the real advantages in doing this, as I mentioned just a moment ago, is so that our team can provide realistic, costed, and carefully evaluated feedback to the study. Specifically, it allows our team to develop a working solution for each case based on actual berth locations, estimated piping distances, specific water transfer rates and volumes, and the applicable regulatory agencies. It creates an opportunity to include figures of marine vessel modifications, port modifications, and shoreside treatment plants in adequate detail to communicate the concepts. And then in doing that, we help stakeholders to understand the concepts and provide meaningful and actionable feedback. Costs, timelines, and considerations discovered in the case study process can then be scaled up to inform stakeholders and policymakers about statewide implementation. Okay, so case study one, Port of Stockton. Now, for selecting Stockton is that it has bulk import-export terminals with somewhat irregular calls from multiple vessel types. For its size and the number of annual vessel calls, it sees significant annual discharge volumes. And it's unique from other ports we've selected in that it's an estuarine environment with a water composition that ranges from mostly fresh to brackish, which, as we know, can be different from the ballast water that's being introduced from various ports of origin. I also want to point out, if I didn't say it, that Stockton is geographically constrained. It's in a small area, so that's different than looking at a port that takes up a lot of space, like Baltimore. So I think it's important to look at both in the study. So here, it's probably hard to see, but there's some yellow pins that we plopped in there from Google Earth, and the top one is the East Complex area, and the one that's lower in your screen is the existing wastewater treatment plant, and I'm going to attempt to point here. So if you look really closely, you might be able to make out a network of existing rail infrastructure within this whole general area, and so the idea is that we could convey the ballast water with a combination of rail cars, it would run to somewhere in this region and then transfer it to an existing pipeline system to deliver it to the existing wastewater treatment plant. Okay, case study two, Port of Oakland. In Oakland, we selected TRAPAC terminal. And the treatment approach at TRAPAC will be to convey the ballast water via a new pipeline from carrier vessels to an on-site storage and wastewater treatment plant. There we go. That's the TRAPAC terminal there in red. So the rationale for selecting Oakland is that it's a busy import-export terminal. Oakland and TRAPAC, is that it's a busy import-export terminal with regular and frequent arrivals from a single vessel type, which is container ships. So obviously very different from Stockton, which sees multiple vessel types. Here we're looking at container ships only. And we wanted to make sure that we incorporated at least one dedicated container terminal in our case study approach, since there are many such large container terminals across the state in Oakland and in the LALB port complex. Oakland also has fairly significant ballast water discharge volumes, comprising just short of 5% of the total statewide discharge volume annually. But here's an overview, kind of a closer-in look at the TRAPAC terminal. And again, I'll mouse over. The idea here is that vessels would transfer ballast water in a pipeline system to a new facility, which could be located perhaps in this area, or perhaps it would have to go within the existing yard space somewhere. So that's what we'll take a look at in that case. Case study three, Port of Hueneme. Vessels, bulk carriers, and even small tankers and container ships. This is basically almost all the six vessel types to be evaluated in the study, with the only exceptions being articulated tug and barge combinations and passenger cruise ships. Port Hueneme also has comparatively small annual discharge volumes, and it'll be important to examine how a small port with small discharge volumes and very limited land space might implement shore-based ballast water treatment, and what that would look like from both an operational standpoint and an economic standpoint. So just for comparison here, some of the data at the bottom. Annual discharge volumes, 7,700 metric tons. And I think I just showed Oakland. Actually, you can see it on the sheet that Kevin passed out. Just compare that 7,700 to some of the other volumes. At 3.7 million for comparison in the LB area. Okay, case study four is El Segundo. In El Segundo, we selected the Chevron Offshore Marine Terminal, which is out here. So the Chevron refinery is on the beach there, obviously, and both refined product and crude product transfers to and from the facility via these underground pipelines and a system of moorings that's approximately 4 miles offshore. So not surprisingly, the treatment approach for this case study that we selected is a mobile marine-based, a marine vessel-based wastewater treatment plant. So the carrier vessel would offload ballast water to the marine vessel, and that vessel then provides both temporary storage and acts as a mobile wastewater treatment plant. So here's just a photo, kind of a pulled back look. And if you look, it might be hard again to see from out there, but way out here, two ships, one at the south berth and one at the north berth. This is just for interest here. Again, hard to see, but there are mooring lines that hold the ships in place if you're not familiar with the terminal. That's really all that's out there. So the rationale for selection of the El Segundo Marine Terminal is that it's a unique offshore location, and there's a physical disconnect between the moorings and the shoreside infrastructure. This introduces some obvious challenges for shore-based ballast water treatment. It's also important to consider because the ballast water discharge volumes at this location are quite significant, as Kevin talked about in our earlier presentation. Also, El Segundo is called on primarily by tank ships, but also on occasion by articulated tug and barge combinations, which do not call at any of our other case study ports, and so we're capturing those here. But here, 400,000 metric tons as compared to Port Hueneme. In the last case study, 7,700. In our last case study, is a port of long wastewater treatment plant. The other would be to use a barge or other marine vessel to convey the water from a berth to the offsite wastewater treatment plant. So, Long Beach was selected in part because it's one of the major port districts in the state, and it comprises approximately 25% of the annual discharge volume statewide, 3.7 million metric tons. And so we felt it was important to evaluate for those reasons alone, but also because it's larger geographically than many other ports and because it sees a seasonal influx of passenger cruise vessels, which the study seeks to evaluate specifically. So that's where we're getting to. Why did we select two terminals? Well, one is we wanted to at least take a good look at what it would involve to convey ballast water by barge from one location in a port to an offsite treatment facility. The other is to capture some of the challenges that might be associated with this geographical, the larger spatial area of a large port. Okay, so just a quick snapshot on the case studies. This is the same thing that you've got in front of you there. And, of course, the intent here is that you can follow along with your finger and string together what the treatment approach or the would be for each case study. So what are our next steps? So from here, we'll march into tasks 2 through 5, which is what we're calling the core assessment of the study. So assessment of retrofitting and or outfitting of vessels, identification, summarization, and assessment of outfitting of ports and wharves, assessment of shore-based ballast water treatment plants, facilities, and assessment of treatment technologies. And so for each of these, we'll look at each of the 5 case study ports. Following that, we'll go to a scale-up process. So here, the data that we develop in each of the case studies will be used as building blocks to be applied to the entire state. We'll make careful assumptions, and they'll be clearly identified. For example, a single container terminal analyzed in Oakland will be used to scale up and represent what it might look like, what shore-based ballast water treatment might look like at other similar locations across the state. So because we're looking at a smattering of different terminal types, we think that we can make reasonable assumptions and scale those up to represent other like terminals and thereby create a broad picture of statewide implementation of shore-based ballast water treatment. So in summary, this approach is practical, feasible, but more importantly, it allows us to dig in and allows us to develop detailed assessments that are informative for stakeholders and bring the real issues to light, and then we use that information.
Full comparison. So we would take a look, to take that container terminal, for example. So looking at the data here for Port of Oakland, that's it's tricky, right? Because that's 1,700 vessel calls, and there's so much data that it's quite interesting. There's actually, in 2013, only 68 ballast water discharges in the Port of Oakland. So the number of calls compared to how many times vessels are actually discharging is, always be careful with data. The types of vessels that call in Oakland is what we would call a low ballast water dependent vessel. They sometimes, frequently, in fact, if you look at 1,700 calls compared to 68 discharges in 2013, most of them are able to manage their ballast water so they don't have to discharge for that type of vessel in that location. So with that noted, once we understand that data, we can then perhaps look at implications in LA Long Beach for container discharges. So how many vessels are there? What's their discharge history? We won't, for example, call the terminal operator in the locations in LA Long Beach because we're limited on scope, but we can look at the numbers and the quantities and the characteristics and scale Oakland appropriately to similar facilities in LA Long Beach. So Oakland lets us dig into details, talk to the people on the ground, see do we have a doable solution there. We then take a look at other locations and say, this one's a little bigger, this one's a little smaller, but they have similar characteristics. Then we scale that appropriately. And we'll identify the cautions that says, we had some particular issues in Oakland that might not apply here. So there will be qualifiers there. Does that help, Bill?
Yeah. That's exactly what I was looking for. How about Audrey?
I just was wondering if you could clarify what you really mean by a case study. Are you taking these locations and mining existing data, or are you going to be doing field work? Or the word case study gets used in a lot of different ways, so I just was hoping you could clarify a bit.
So we're creating case studies. How about that? So we're going to do original work to assess, and if you can see from the pattern in this 11 by 17 sheet, it was a little bit of a check the box exercise. We made sure as we went through this, one, that each case study was a potentially doable alternative, something that could practically be done. Within that, we made sure that we hit all six vessel types that we want to study in California. And within that, we made sure we hit each of the methods of conveyance and each of the treatment approaches. So once we have that, we now have what we think is a doable combination for a given case study. So, for instance, let's let you to maybe help describe it.
Yeah, I don't know if we want to call it a preliminary design and developing all the design criteria. I mean, that's a pretty specific thing. It's more of a feasibility level approach, which is, you know, feasibility level cost estimates, which is based on less than 1% design. It's the AACE level 4 cost estimating, which is, you know, minus 30% plus 50%. There's all guidelines associated with that. And that's what we're looking at. We're not looking at developing drawings or PNIDs or anything for the processes to move it towards design. It's a feasibility level approach.
So the data that you're collecting is existing data that you're pulling together for this, or are you going to be doing more field stuff also? Or?
No, we're...
Can I add something? I'm sorry, you were asking Jean a question. I wanted to and I'm sorry to jump in, but the we have familiarity with each of these facilities, the ones that were selected. They were selected partially for that reason. So we have an understanding of what the regional wastewater treatment plant's capabilities are, what the infrastructure that's available there. And so from my perspective, what I was looking at is this would be done at a concept level with an understanding of working with the existing system, what it would take to actually address each one of these individual issues. So it's going to be a real-time evaluation from my perspective.
Maybe give you something you can sink your teeth into is for like the vessel outfitting, that'll be original. It'll be informed by what's been done in the past, but that's an original. Those will be original assessments of vessels based on designs that are available. And it's okay. What does it cost to run a pipe from here to here? What do we have to do to the pump to meet the head requirements, the pressure requirements for this case study? So yes, it's mining the existing data and it's original engineering to inform a feasibility level assessment of what's happening. So yes, engineering design will take place. That's original, informed by the existing information in the literature and other sources to reach this feasibility level of what can be done. Is it practical? What's the rough order of magnitude cost?
Steve.
Thank you. It strikes me that there's an aspect of a meta-analysis here because you're going to be transferring unit cost information from one case to essentially inform the final project analysis. And I guess my main question is, it sounds like you're
reasonably informed about every place is a special case in some ways. So we need to be aware of that. And in fact, the reason to dig into these five case studies is to find out how often are these special instances in each location going to drive the assessment.
Thank you.
So I have a question. Why would you pick El Segundo? I mean, I have no reason why not to pick it. I'm just wondering why, because it's out in the middle of nowhere. And so what do you hope that you can get from that would make it more scalable? And I'm not being critical. I'm just asking a question.
Oh, no, it's a very fair question. Thank you. And it's a good one to get out in the open and talk about. And, yeah, this is a unique terminal. It's not very much like any others in the state, with the exception of maybe the Pacific Area Lightering, which is further offshore. But it's unique. It has significant discharges. And it's an area where if we're going to implement shore-based ballast water treatment, how are we going to deal with it in this case? And so I think that there merits taking a close look at it. And it's also a kind of a perfect fit for an evaluation of the marine vessel-based storage and wastewater treatment plant.
Good answer.
Do you want to add to that at all?
Yeah, no, I think that's great. That's exactly what I was looking for.
Yeah, it's that physical disconnect between
right. It's
their positions at the moorings offshore and any kind of shoreside infrastructure that makes it worth studying in detail.
Yeah, good, yeah. Thanks. Has the panel got any more questions?
I have
one. Okay.
I'm a little concerned that we're studying specific docks in a specific port. And what I said earlier today about if we're looking at zero tolerance on leakage, we should be looking at zero tolerance on ships. How do you relate the docks in Stockton to the docks that are a mile upstream and a mile downstream and the one guy that goes in to certain places, certain times? I mean, I see in these photographs, these overhead photographs, you circled the docks that you're looking at, but then I see ships all over the place. How do you propose to include ships that aren't container ships? For instance, you're looking at a container ship terminal. I'm sure there's other ships that come in. How do you, and they may be 3 miles away, they may be 6 miles the other way. How do we capture for each one of these ports the entire ship arrivals and ship discharges?
Yeah, that, as always, insightful, Rick. As you're catching there is good. It's not only is this port-specific, but we're looking at terminal-specific within a port. Ports themselves are highly complicated. So the scale-up really comes from the terminal, then to the port, then to the, call it the region, because as vessel that is a bulk carrier that calls at a terminal it doesn't traditionally call at. How do you avoid these corner cases? So that's important for us to not miss that. With the case study, we feel the need to dig into some details and come up with, start with, call it the basics, and then see how can that envelope that covers, call it the 80% of the vessels, reach out to capture that extra 20.
I think you understand. I know you understand my concern here. It's just that if we start saying that yes, we can put up, the conclusion is that there's a shoreside treatment in Stockton, for instance, that means that all ships calling into Stockton should be shoreside treating. And that's not necessarily true.
Absolutely noted, and we'll take it carefully here in our notes to, if a solution is working for 80% of the vessels and it's impractical for the other 20%, we need to note that so that the wrong impression isn't taken away that, quote-unquote, Stockton has got shore-based treatment, it's all set, doesn't get misinterpreted into thinking that it's a one-size-fits-all for Stockton broadly. We'll have to be very careful in how we communicate that.
Yes. And again, I don't understand what percentage of the ships that are deballasting are in each one of these studies. You know, are you getting 50% of the ships that come into the Port of Stockton and 50% of the ballast ships that come into Long Beach? Are you getting 10%, 50%, 80%? I mean, are these the right ports to choose as far as ballast water quantities go?
So discharge is captured by the case.
So on the basis of port-wide discharges, if you look in the it's the second column here, percent of total discharges statewide. So for each of these ports, that's their percentage of total discharges statewide. It's not specific to each of the individual terminals that we've looked at because we don't have a way to extract that data specifically from NBIC. But what we can do as we march forward into tasks 2 through 5, since we have relationships with some folks at these terminals, we may be able to narrow that down a bit and try to single out in fact, we expect to be able to estimate with reasonable accuracy the discharge volumes that they're seeing there.
Wouldn't you want to pick out ports that have the highest ballast water percentage in the state?
Well, we believe we have in some of the cases, but I don't think you want to look at those exclusively, right? It's just as important to look at how shore-based ballast water treats.
That's a bulk carrier. Ballast water discharges. So while the numbers are quite low, the volumes are actually fairly high. So we're trying to pick this combination here that captures the variety as opposed to just going and saying we hit 80% of all the discharges, because that 20% presents its own unique challenges that we have to watch out for.
Okay.
But points very well noted. The takeaways from this are, let's not confuse getting 80% answer and miss those 20% of the extra vessels, because the point here is having a 100% solution.
Thank you.
Yeah, Christine.
I want to put something out on the table right now that I was talking with George at lunch about. There's a number of objectives that are tasks that are involved in this, and you have indicated that you're going to be reporting on tasks 2 through 5 using these case studies. Yeah, we're not going to be talking with you again until substantial other developments. And it seems to me that with the concern and the somewhat confusion as to that, that maybe we should be considering reviewing with you those findings before you go into task six and the rest. And then one more comment in terms of just the general nature, thinking about the environment that each one of these reports is in. Are there some unique risk assessment components regarding the natural environment that need to be included in your considerations of what's feasible and what's infeasible? Because I haven't seen any attention to, you know, any adjacent MPAs or any sort of relationship that that might have to your outcomes.
So on the first note, we're going to be touching on some of the additional tasks past task five as we're doing two through five. So there will be some overlap. You just can't avoid it. On a pass to George to think about additional stakeholder meetings.
In discussing with Christine this afternoon, we talked about the possibilities of having maybe a webinar between Klausen and the panel if the need arises. So we'll be in conversation as the project moves along. And at some point, you know, we'll make the determination if there's need to be
studies. There will be, and I'm sorry we didn't address it in the matrix there, there will be consideration to what's acceptable discharges in those different locations. Maybe pass to Jean if he has any insight as to special considerations in terms of effluent.
Not really at this time. I mean, there's NPDES permits, but there's permits, there's potential for combined outflows with land-based systems, but I don't think we're really there yet to explore that. I think we need flows and treatment and kind of work in that methodology towards the permitting.
You know, from my perspective, the good news is that we've really got design criteria that we've got to meet. And it's not rocket science, really. I mean, it's not as tough as wastewater treatment or as variable as stormwater, for example. I mean, this stuff is going to be variable, yes, but it's really – we're looking at biological impact. And probably is worth somebody's time – to actually start talking to some regulators to say, when we take ballast water off of a ship, it's still ballast water. It would be a shame to call it a hazardous waste, and I would never suggest that we do that. But you know what I mean. I mean, it's not the same thing as even a stormwater, where you're going to have a myriad of things from greases and oils to heavy metals and all sorts of other things in there. It seems like it was not too soon to start thinking about this, because that could inform the way you approach this. Because when I know, as Jean and I think about wastewater treatment, that's a lot more complex than this. I mean, you know, we're talking about getting rid of high BOD and COD waters and generating a sludge, which, depending on how you look at it, is beneficial or not. But I think that it's maybe not too early to think about what is this. And I don't even know who to talk to about something like that. I mean, what are the regulators going to say this water really is when it comes off a ship?
So that's a good example of this little bit of overlap that we're going to have. Permits is task number 7. So we're absolutely going to be talking about permits. And that's one of the reasons to do the case studies, so that there is somebody to call on the line and you say, yes, we're talking about this location for where the vessel is. We're talking about a pipeline that would need to go from here to here. If it's sent to that wastewater treatment plant, how do we classify that water now so that we can pressure the regulatory agencies some to write opinions, give us advice as to what the color of that water might be as it gets sent from one location right. To the next in this stream. So in these case studies, that is a factor for us.
Sure, and that's where water quality, trying to get a grip on the very.
So it's a yes and no. For example, at El Segundo, in that case, that would have 100%. And when we think about Port Hueneme, I actually don't think it's 100%. There are some auxiliary docks in that port that aren't captured. So I would say, Rick, you know, it's a great question for us to think about and talk with Delta Stewardship. Should we also pick a terminal, or I mean a port location, that does have a variety of vessel types, and see what would that network within that single port look like? It's a valid question, Rick. My
concern is we're skewing the answer without identifying what we've skipped. We give the answer to two locations in Stockton. What about the other 14? Do those ships just go out of business?
So what would be interesting to look at, so when you talk about Stockton, maybe describe a little bit the variety of discharges at Stockton, if you can, Peter.
There's really only two berth complexes within the Port of Stockton, the East Complex and the West Complex. We're choosing to evaluate the East Complex. The West Complex we didn't select because it has very few vessel calls, and so we limited it to the Eastern Complex, and they have discharges. They have both, they're import-export. So on the export side, it's raw materials, it's grains and agricultural products, and on the import side, it'd be manufactured things like project cargoes, you know, steel structures coming in from Asia, or steel coils, or things of that nature.
So the question then is, by looking at one of those two complexes and studying it in detail, can we or can we not scale that study of one complex to the other complex in a practical manner, in a manner that we can all look at it and nod our heads and say, yeah, we got it? Or are we going to have a gap there, and when we go to scale it, we're going to say, nah, that doesn't really fit, that doesn't scale nicely? And then the risk that you're pointing at, Rick, would be we look at the other terminals that we've identified and we don't quite find a match. And we say, geez, we've got something outside of what we identified that won't scale up or down. So the challenge now, if we look at it, is go ahead and take Long Beach. So we're proposing two terminal locations within Long Beach. There's a lot more than two terminal locations in Long Beach. You know, one that we're looking at would be a cruise ship terminal, and another is
scrap steel.
So there's a lot more going on there in Long Beach. So at a point in time, say, oh, we think we got it, or say, no, we better throw a wider net to capture more.
Yeah, I think I'd go along with Christine's thought about having an interim discussion so that we know what we're going to get. What are the outliers that we're going to miss? I would go along with that.
Yeah, and I think we can do that by like a webinar or something, reasonably easy. I mean, that way we don't have to travel. We can all sit at home and still get the same thing. Because I think Rick, I think you've brought up a good point. You know, we know what we know, and we know what we don't know, and we don't know what we don't know. And you really don't. I don't like the guy that said that, but
you don't know what you don't know.
That's right.
Unknowables.
But that's what you're getting at, I think, is just a better. We want to feel that we've covered all of the bases when we get done. So I think that we can think about some sort of a webinar where we can all get together. And
it kind of gets back to how you define the boundary conditions of these case studies. So if the case study is a port, then you draw your boundary conditions there and you look at all of the traffic and then you can draw conclusions. But if you're sort of cherry picking part of it, then, you know, I think that's our confusion here, is that you're biasing your result, that you might be missing something that we won't know what it is, you know. So
Todd gave me a little note, and he said, and the note said, if you show it to me again.
Right under the bus.
it's we're studying or exploring the feasibility of this shore-based approach, not solving the problems at each and every terminal. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but it's just that's a great scoping question. We could, you know, just when we identify that it's practical or not practical for 4.6% of the discharges coming from container ships in the Port of Oakland, here's a feasible solution. That's information that we can use. And then maybe when we get back together, we think, okay, do we think it's feasible? To what extent do we need to come to the conclusive answer for what the full cost and scope of for the state of California is? This is a good topic because we are, I wouldn't say cherry picking, we're carefully selecting a variety of examples that we can get details on so that we find those cases that we can't find solutions for, or we determine what the effort is for those boundary cases.
There's trade-offs in different ways of doing it, and so you
touched on it when he was given his presentation, and I think some of the questions have kind of nibbled around the edges on it a little. When I first saw the treatment approaches that we were going to use at each facility in a list form, I was like, I don't know that that's the treatment approach that just inherently that I think would be appropriate for that facility. But then when I see it on this table that, you know, what Kevin and Peter have done is they're trying to fill out every box in that matrix to make sure that we've looked at each one of those treatment approaches, even if it may not be the one that you ultimately pick for that facility. So there's, I think that's all getting wrapped up in some of the things that we're talking about right now.
You got a partial ANOVA here, analysis of variance. So, are there any more questions from the panel? Because if not, we could open it up to the public. Is that correct, George?
Yes.
Do we have some? Oh, we have a person that has some questions. Two persons. Just make sure that we can hear you when you speak into the microphone.
Hello. Karen McDowell, San Francisco Estuary Partnership. Couple questions, and I had a lot of thoughts on Rick's comments. So one of them's just in the chart, because you guys are bouncing between these numbers here, which I guess are for the whole port. But then you're saying, oh, we're looking at this terminal, and this terminal's 4.6% of the discharges, but that's not really – that's for the whole port, or is that for the one
– No, you're absolutely right. That is for the entire port. And so what the challenge will be as we go into tasks 2 through 5 is to gather data – the data that we can obtain from these terminals, and we can calculate or estimate with accuracy, right, Kevin, the quantities that would be discharged based on the number of vessel calls and the vessel types. So we will have to go back and try to rework those numbers so that they're specific to each terminal.
So one, I think just the terminology is a little dangerous because you keep thinking, oh, we're going to test 4.6%, but you're not. You're testing a subset of that. So I think you need to be a little clearer on what you're testing. And then the scaling issue, I think, and I get the matrix here, and that makes sense. You're testing all the different things, and you test the different types. But maybe there needs to be a second level. Maybe you do this, and then you do the whole Port of Oakland or something and see. Because there's going to be those weird cases where maybe you can't get 100% of vessels. And that's what we're looking at. We're looking at making it a requirement for all the vessels. So I think it's important to
appreciate it on recognizing that if we're looking at a terminal within a port, that number is and doesn't represent the whole port. Our challenge here is there's these different, there's not, we don't have at our fingers the basic data, the basic information that looks at what it takes for these vessel types, these conveyance means, and these treatment approaches. So unlike other cases, you could look it up. And then so these case studies are helping us develop that basic engineering, those basic costs that then let us scale it up. And I think this is a good theme from this feedback, which is once we get this information, we need to discuss it again. We need to shed some light on it as we head towards scale up and see, do we need to look at an entire port, all the intricacies, all the vessels upstream and downstream. On the barge piece, we're by no means limiting or restricting the treatment technologies that we look at to those technologies proposed or being commercialized for shipboard treatment. We'll have to look at the footprint available on the barges, the tankage, the other things on the barges, but while it'll potentially include a lot of the shipboard treatment approaches, it's by no means limited to that.
Okay. Well, there he is, hiding behind the pole there.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to comment. My name is John Berg. I'm with the Pacific Merchant Shipping Association. We've been following this issue for a long time. And in regards to the case study and scale-up issue, you know, I'm not arguing with the process, and I understand that, you know, you have to have some sort of a scope of work to wrap your arms around. It seems obviously you're looking at choosing these case studies based on addressing the various groups of conveyance, the various groups of vessel types, different port sizes. But I also want to just comment, and perhaps I'm getting ahead of the game here, but, you know, ports all compete with each other as well, and there's an economic perspective. And I think you have some pretty good representation in terms of large ports, small ports. Port of Oakland, for example, that particular terminal, it's probably a good representative terminal in terms of a container terminal. Probably somewhat similar in terms of type of vessel, type of conveyance you might have, some of the logistical issues with a port in LA or Long Beach. However, the Port of Oakland is probably considered somewhat of a discretionary port. In terms of container ships. Now, Port of Oakland might not want to hear that, but that's probably the truth, whereas Port of LA and Long Beach are not. So Port of Oakland would probably be much more sensitive economically to the impacts of having a shore-based treatment system requirement than the Port of LA Long Beach. Similarly, El Segundo, again, representing tanker vessels, you know, that is essentially a proprietary terminal that feeds a refinery. And consequently,
we've got plenty of time, so we're welcome to comment on that.
Well, what I can say is that when one of our tasks as we move into the main body of work in this study is the market implications. There's a specific task which incorporates taking a look at what this will mean both on a statewide scale and a port-wide scale for cargo movements and competitiveness. And so we'll be looking at that, and Dennis King will be assisting with that carefully in coming up with some economic realities that this is going to introduce.
Yeah, Peter's already reaching out to the various port associations and port operators to understand their drivers. I'm sure Steve can give some insight as well on how difficult it is to try to put a cost or a driver on the cost of compliance and on differential cost between ports and unintended consequences of things not being even, or if one port, it's more expensive to treat ballast water as compared to another port, what's that going to do to what's going to do to their viability. John's comment on how Oakland is discretionary compared to L.A. Long Beach as non-discretionary, in other words, the cargo can divert from Oakland, but it's probably not going to divert from L.A. Long Beach. That's important to know. It's going to be very difficult to grapple and quantify those sort of impacts. But yeah. As Peter's noting, it's task 12 is to put effort into what those market impacts are, and a lot of that's going to be outreach to folks like John Berg and folks at the ports associations.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and we've established some of those lines of communication already, and we don't pretend to understand completely all of those impacts. That's definitely going to take, like Kevin said, reaching out and initiating some discussion. And once we've flushed out tasks 2 through 5 a little bit, then they'll be able to comment more specifically about what this might mean for them economically, and in terms of their competitiveness as compared to other ports.
Along those lines, California. To John's point, I mean, there's always discussion in the California port arena of are our fees diverting cargo away from the United States and to Mexico or Prince Rupert. So those are all always things that even we all need to keep in mind.
All right. Any more public questions or comments? And did we address your questions
for today? So, well, let's break here for about 10, 15 minutes. Yeah. Come back 2:15.
And anybody in the back there that would like to make any comments or something, you know, we're
participation.
We put muzzles on most of us, so we won't bite. Except Rick. All right, I think we're back after our seventh inning stretch this afternoon. And I'm going to, first of all, I think before we go any further, I'd just like to ask the panel one last time if they have any questions or clarifications. And then if not, I'm going to turn it over.
How about
comments? Absolutely. You want to comment? Okay.
Yeah, one of the issues that came up during our conversation was this idea that perhaps a unifying theme to what Rick and others have been talking about is this idea of versatile approaches, so that if you have ports that have a variety of vessel types and circumstances, that at the end of the line, what we're going to need are treatment approaches that are versatile to be able to address the diversity that may be present in such a port. And that may or may not be congruent with the kind of the initial thinking on the case study approach. Thank you.
Great, thanks. I think, okay, Rainer, you're going to explain what
sure.
You're going to do?
Yes, maybe it would be helpful just to get everyone up to speed on next steps and what the mechanics are now of incorporating your thinking of the external review panel into a document and that is really helpful to you, and how we then what the decision process is to then work through the next tasks, especially those that are interrelated and somewhat dependent on each other. So the plan is to have a report back to you within roughly 30 days, and that way, in the meantime, you can still keep working on your economic analyses and calling regulatory agencies, from Fish and Wildlife to State Water Board and State Lands Commission and everything else, so that you can then possibly even integrate some of the comments into you're thinking for future tasks that haven't been completed yet. So I realized today that there was a lot of interconnectedness between us that we won't really know what that yet entails until we have the feasibility study in hand. There may be a need for additional drilling down to make sure that 100% of California ports are really covered, and that may be another project down the line. So I think we're making a good start, and we'll see what the feasibility, what the feasibility will be in about 12, 18 months, or I've forgotten now. So with that, I just wanted to thank everyone for participating and for a lively and very, very helpful exchange.
Yeah, I would like just to ask a procedural question of you guys, and that is when we have our webinar between the team and the panel, that's not going to be open to the public, but that doesn't mean that it's not public. How do we work, how do we deal with that so that we maintain our transparency?
Those meetings usually will have some kind of a summarized notes or minutes, which we will then pass it around, and once it's okay, we will post it on the web.
Okay.
So it is transparent at that point.
Okay. Yep.
Another procedural one. Will the report back to us separate literature review comments from case study comments? I think the case study is going to be a very dynamic, ongoing discussion through the whole process here. And it's, from my point of view, particularly Steve's last comment, that we want to make sure that as we develop these building blocks for the case studies, analysis that just hasn't been done before, we don't want to lose sight of the versatility. And that's a perfect word, versatility to cover a port. So I see that conversation continuing. And maybe it's a request that we get literature review comments that are a little bit separate so we can complete that task and then keep the conversation going on the case study.
It will be separate, Kevin. The literature survey report comments and report will be separate.
So what the panel is going to do is give comments back on what we heard today and what we've reviewed, and then some recommendations. And then in terms of literature review, I think collectively we may be able to offer some other guidance on some other studies to consider. But they're not totally discrete because they inform one another. But I guess maybe what you're saying is the literature review is kind of is finished, I guess, and is what you're thinking.
Always looking to close things when possible.
Fair enough. Is there any more discussion from any of you in the viewing gallery out there? Are you I don't see anybody jumping up with a piece of paper in their hand, so I guess that's fine. George, I think it's your turn.
Yeah, I wanna get some final comments from the panel.
Steve, do you have any comments?
Not at this time.
Christine?
I just want to thank the presenters as to clarifying the content of the literature, and I think that our written report is going to be the most important thing for you after we have a chance to digest and look at things and recommend things. I look forward to working with you in the months to come. Thank you.
Thank you. Rick, you want to?
I think, yes, I want to thank the authors for all the good work that they've done. I think I opened up by saying that this is an area that's not been really done very well before. There's been dabbling around the edges, and you're plowing new ground, and it's very comprehensive, and it's very difficult to try to grasp it all. But I think you're doing a great job, and I encourage you to continue, and I hope our comments have been helpful.
Thank you. Audrey.
I guess I'd like to echo that. I think this is a really challenging and important topic, and it's kind of exciting to pull this different information together. So look forward to working with you moving forward. And good effort thus far.
What I want to say is I want to thank George and Rainer here for having us here. I think they pulled together five people with totally different backgrounds, which is to your benefit, and hopefully will better inform the final product of this feasibility study. I personally look forward to our next meeting. I can't wait to do that and see how you've come along. And flexibility and I think also the ability to dance. And that is that we can sit here and say this is the way to go, and then you're going to go home and say, wait a minute, that's not the way to go. And it's I don't think we're so constrained that we wouldn't entertain some deviance, let's say deviations rather than deviance, maybe a better word. And I think the point is we've had a great meeting, and we'll give you guys a chance to say from your perspective. But I think it's been a very productive meeting. It's fun to get to know you, and still in the review process, I think it's going to be a really great opportunity to work together and get a really, really good product. So thank you very much.
So why don't we start down the end with Ross and for our team? I think we've gone into enough of the details here. So we'll keep it at a similar level as the panel.
Go
ahead, Ross. Do what you got to do.
I tend to ramble, is what he's trying to control.
And also the public for the comments that we got today. It's been really helpful to see all these different perspectives on the work we've done so far, and I'm looking forward to working with the team to incorporate it in the future. Thanks.
I'd like to say that I am particularly impressed by the level of thought that has gone into all your questions to us, and the takeaway for me is that there is a very genuine interest on all of your parts that this study be as well done as it possibly can be, and that's encouraging, and we're really excited to be a part of it, and thank you for that. It's been fun.
Yeah, I wanted to thank the panel also. It's always good to see old friends again and to work with them in different capacities and meet new ones. I did want to just touch on one technical point, and it's appropriate for me to do it because I was a little bit more of an observer to the process than or maybe it's not, and Kevin will let me know. But when we're talking about the case study, and Glosson did the majority of the work, obviously they went with Kennedy Jenks and the other team members to try to optimize this system. But the way that I look at it is if this study were to try to fix the whole problem or determine what it would take to fix the whole problem, the depth would be very thin. We would be able to determine how much flow, what kind of vessels in different parts, and we'd get an idea of how much water needed to be treated to a certain level. We could take some cost estimates from what it takes to do treatment, apply it across the board, get a global number. On the other end of the spectrum, if we dove into one port or one terminal, maybe we could get for the scope and budget of this project, maybe we could get a 10% design out of that. And we could really know what the issues are drilling all the way down. And what we try to do through this process, and again, you know, hats off to Glosson doing the first cut of this, is where do we compromise on that breadth and depth so the scale up becomes as accurate as possible? And I thought this was pretty close hitting on the mark, but I wanted to leave you with that because we've had a lot of discussion, and as that, you know, breadth and depth kind of expanded and breathed in different ways during that discussion, we're not quite there with the form. And any more thoughts, ruminations on that and feedback to us, I think would be helpful. Because what we're really trying to do is get the scale up that is the most accurate on these key points of information that we need to see if it's feasible. So, and again, thank you all.
Well, as everyone said, and for me as well, it's always exciting and fun to work with
Well, absolute thanks to Jean for elegantly painting that picture, and I like that stress. I like that push and pull and that poking at this case study approach. If we weren't having that stress, if we weren't pushing it back and forth, we're probably not working hard to answer the problem. We're probably taking an easy road. So our team here is very much trying to answer the problem, and we appreciate your inputs. It's going to force us to make sure we're not leaving things missed and so forth. Nice meeting some of you for the first time. Nice meeting you, seeing you again for others, and very much look forward to moving to the next step. And please keep up the strong comments and the passion from your side, because we certainly have it on this side.
I think that just about does it. Thank you very, very much, everybody, the video crew over here, the folks in the back, and the folks around the table and out in front here. If I had a gavel, I would hit it right now and say case closed.
Thank you very much. Meeting adjourned.
Meeting adjourned.